Welcome to Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our third series, and the series is on Vietnam. And it's important that you know, when we started this, we really wanted to not deal with it so much as a political event, but how it affected families. You know, one of the things that we've mentioned before, that while there were over 58,000 men and women killed in Vietnam as a result of the war, that all of those people had families. And so the extended families, so there's a lot more lives affected than just those that were killed. And also, I would like to introduce at this time, this is retired Colonel Greta Kammermeyer. And now we're going to call her Greta under her instructions to do that. I'm trying to follow instructions like a military person. And Greta was a nurse in Vietnam. And Greta, tell me, you worked in which hospital in Vietnam?
I was at the 24th Evac at Long Binh from January of 1967 through March, through May of 68, so a little over a year.
So you went through the Big Tet then, during that time?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I actually arrived. We landed during Tet of 67, when the ammunition dump had been hit at Long Binh. And so my introduction was 5 days of explosions as the ammo dump was just firing away all of the arsenal that we had there.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. So you worked primarily with, you were saying, neurological patients?
Well, actually, when I first arrived, I was the head nurse of a medical unit, a medical ward for 6 months. And then my last 8 months, I was head nurse of the neurosurgical intensive care unit. And it was sort of curious because the majority of casualties are medical casualties. They're not surgical candidates, which I think you usually think of as the war wounded, so it takes a whole mind switch to think about the type of nursing or the type of care you provide over there.
And you mentioned you had lots of spinal cord injuries, that kind of thing?
Yeah, the neurosurgical ward had both head injuries and spinal cord injuries, but those were superimposed on other types of wounds also, so it wasn't just a spinal cord injury or just a head injury. There were other wounds and bellies and everything. So we did, the nurses did a lot of the taking care of wounds and suturing and things like that over the course of a patient's stay on the ward. It was a complicated time.
It was a complicated time, and I would imagine there must have been some gratification just for being able to do that and to be able to help. At the same time, you've got the opposite of these young men and women that are, you know, critically injured and are going to go back to a world that's very different than what they have right now.
Well, there are two parts to that. Is when I was working on the medical ward and people came in with a dengue fever or fever of unknown origin or malaria or something like that. So you take them through their first stage of recovery, and then you realize that they're now well enough to go back to war and possibly get killed the second time around. And so you feel this, there's really this tearing of, you know, I wish this person would be sent home instead of going back to war. And on the neurosurgical ward, you don't think about this is, you know, nurses and medical staff are supposed to be there taking care of the sick and wounded. So it's where you need it to be. And the, I don't know that you would call it gratification.
Well, yeah, that's
as much as that, that we were doing our job.
Right.
If we could, and we did a good job. But you know, the soldiers and you know, individuals that were wounded and then were sent home still had a lifetime of having to deal with their disability at that time.
Yeah, yeah. I've been in a wheelchair since 1971, so I have some understanding of what someone with a spinal cord injury has to go through too. Let me ask you this. What, you know, I've asked every one of my persons that I've interviewed so far, I've asked them this, and that is, when you landed in Vietnam, what was your first impression?
Hot, humid, muggy, what the hell are we doing here?
Bingo, you just got what, you know, it's interesting, yeah, that's what everybody says. Kind of interesting because they always say, I think one of the comments from one of the military people that I interviewed said, you could chew the air. It was so hot and thick.
I flew across with three other nurses that were on the airplane. We all had, you know, our hair was sort of curled. And we were in uniform, and, you know, you get off the plane, and all of a sudden, your hair goes absolutely straight. And our first night in our hooch was to cut one another's hair, because we knew that it was not going to survive anything other than, you know, being short and easy to handle.
Yeah, beauty was not the issue at that time, I guess. It was convenience and whatever works, yeah. Yeah, even when I was in high school, I had very long hair, and now it's very short. I still have hair, but it's very short. So that's good. And the other thing that I think that people mentioned to me was just the smell of the place. That, you know, you're landing in airfields, there's you know, almost a diesel smell almost every place you go. So that, now you mentioned also that your folks were grandparents or your folks were resistance fighters in Europe during World War II.
Yeah, well, I was born and raised in Norway, and my parents were part of the support for the Norwegian underground. And so we had and sheltered those needing to be protected before they could escape into Sweden. And so my mother would walk me around, for example, in the baby, pushing the baby carriage, and we would jump into an alleyway, and I would be picked up, handed to my mother, and they would take the guns out from underneath my mattress and go on their merry way. And so I feel like I was always involved in some sort of resistance. But that was part of my makeup, I think, trying to see if I would be as brave as my parents.
Yeah, that must have been and they certainly presented a great model for you, if that's the case,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
And for doing what's right and all those kinds of things. Did you, when you came back to the United States, how was your reception? Just,
oh, you're talking about from Vietnam?
Yes.
Well, we had certainly heard about, you know, we came back in 68, so it wasn't quite as negative as it came to be over time of having served in Vietnam. But we came back, actually, and moved into the country and sort of isolated ourselves. And we had no radio, we had no television, we did not get the newspaper, and we were just building a our own little mini farm. And I say we because my husband was also stationed in Vietnam, and I extended so that we would come back together.
Now, was he was in the military?
Yes, he was.
Uh-huh.
And so our whole trajectory was a little bit different. When we came back, we came back to New York and then picked up a car that was waiting for us and drove across country. So we, you know, we just stayed away from anything that had to do with Vietnam.
Yeah, I think sometimes, you know, sometimes when I go on vacation, I try and not turn on the TV. And, you know, what I found is I really don't miss that much, you know.
And nowadays, if you just wait a week, it'll be the same news.
Yeah.
Only some of the things that would have caused stress would be gone, and some decision will have been made.
I think we've, you know, I think we've really, you know, there's done a pretty good job with this COVID, but I have seen enough people getting injections on TV now to last me a lifetime. And also to see those little orange bottles with the little, you know, go down the conveyor belt that are being sent someplace.
I think the message, I don't want to skip this one because I think the message here is that the vaccine is safe. It is necessary. And you and I may not need to see those pictures because we may already have gotten our vaccine and it's not an issue. But this is for those people who are still in doubt. And so the message needs to be repeated and repeated and repeated, just like we had lies repeated over again for 4 years.
Yeah.
To put up with 4 years of repetition of injections is minor by comparison.
Yeah, that's I agree with you, and I think that I still have friends that don't like to get injections, and so I always say, my gosh, the needles now are so easy that it's nothing compared to what they were. And
come on, get a life, move on. Yeah. It takes 10 seconds. You go out and you get bit by a mosquito or a bee or something like that.
Yeah, yep.
This is absolutely nonsense.
Yeah, I've been in hospital enough times to have, IVs, and I just kind of, as I go in the door, I put my wrist up, so that. So would you also feel comfortable about telling me a little bit about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell lawsuit that you went through?
Yes, well, late in life, I realized that I had gotten a divorce and then realized that I was a lesbian. And met somebody, and that somebody and I have been together now for nearly 33 years. But at the time, I was still in the military, and although I knew that there was a policy that said you couldn't be homosexual because it was incompatible with military service, I had already been in for 25 years. And when I was applying for a top secret clearance to make an application to go to the War College, I spoke my truth, which at the time was, I am a lesbian. And that resulted in 6 months later, me being told that I was going to be discharged. And I resisted that. And for 2 years, I continued to serve in silence prior to the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But then I was discharged through an administrative board. We challenged my discharge in federal court. By that time, the regulation had been changed to a law that was Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which meant that you could serve in the military, but you couldn't tell anybody that you were.
Yeah.
If you did, that was sufficient for discharge. And so for 17 years, while that law was enacted, we had over 13,000 individuals who were discharged because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, not because of misconduct.
You said 13,000?
Yes.
Wow.
More than. And this was a policy that was untenable, and particularly for women, because if say somebody wanted for you to go out on a date, and you sort of rebuffed their advances, and then were threatened with, if you don't go out and have sex with me, I will disclose that you are a lesbian, regardless of whether or not you were.
Wow.
So there was always the threat of being labeled homosexual and ending up getting discharged, because it's, you know, it was just one of those things. How do you disprove your sexual orientation?
Yes.
You know, it was untenable. And so there were all sorts of bad things about that law. And now, you know, with the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in 2010, and then the implementation in 2011, the trans service members were not included in that policy or in that regulation. And so now President Biden, at the end of April, that policy for trans open service will be totally enacted so that they can serve with the dignity and respect and their gender identity.
I think that's really important. You know, it's I don't know how old you are, but I'm 73. All right,
you're a youngster.
Oh, well, thank you. We can conclude the interview right then, and I'm just gonna kind of sit around the office and gloat for a while. You know, it was an entirely different thing then.
Yes.
You know, and one of my best friends, Tom Wolfshire, I grew up with him, ran around with him, did everything with him. Had no idea that he was gay until I saw him 20 years later, and you know, in a gas station. And so we've kept in contact really well. When you you were always at Long Bend, pretty much at the hospital there.
Yes, I was.
Okay.
And so it when I first got there, it was just a little base, but over the months, it became the headquarters for the Army and the Southern Command. So it became a huge base.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you mentioned that the dump that had all the weapons in it, one of the people that I interviewed earlier was stationed very close to Long Bend, and he was on a tower, guard tower. And he says that it was interesting. They could not hear it from where he was, but he said it just entirely lit up the entire sky.
Yeah,
so
it had already been hit when we were coming into the airport, and, you know, it was pitch black at night. And looking down, you saw this huge fire, and you could see the intervals of explosions taking place. And even for a novice coming in from the civilian, you know, from a peaceful world, you knew that had to be an ammunition dump. It was impressive.
Yeah. One of the things that I wanted to go over, too, that you mentioned was, again, that I seems to be repetitive, is whether I talked to people that were pilots, whether I talked to people who were on the ground, and there have been, I think, 12 people that are from Vashon that were killed in the war. They all said we were just doing our job. Is that you think it's a fair statement?
Well, you know, first of all, I mean, you have to separate things out, and it would start with what the hell were we doing there?
Yes.
We all drank the Kool-Aid and believed that our government knew what they were doing and that we were there for the right reason in terms of preventing the domino effect of communism sweeping through the Far East. And, you know, as a service member, your job is to follow the orders that you were there, as long as they were lawful orders. And I think that's where things got really muddy over time for combat troops, because they got sometimes really bad orders, like in the book called Kill Anything That Moves. You see the horrendous treatment of civilians done by our troops in our name. And those were not lawful orders. And so it's like you can just be shocked at what happened over there. And you realize that, no, it wasn't just following orders. I mean, this is sort of repetition of World War II and the concentration camps. And our troops did bad things over there. And, you know, I think some of us, like being in the hospitals, we were sort of isolated from that and naive and thinking that things were just all that we were doing was on behalf of the South Vietnamese. We believed that. You had to believe it.
You know, one of my good friends was a conscientious objector and was a medic in Vietnam. And the one thing that I asked him, I said, what's the one thing that kind of sticks in your mind? And he said that they would go in and do pacification with villages after there had been battles and things. And he said that he just remembers taking kids that were injured back to, you know, first aid stations. And I think that's a pretty heavy load to carry in some respects. And, in my graduating class, I graduated in 66. There were, out of a small town, Ellensburg, there were 30 males from my graduating class that went right into Vietnam. So they were just kind of grabbed out of that little farm community and dropped in a jungle thousands of miles away. And, you know, how do you justify that? And do you think that, and I also asked this question, do you think the war in Vietnam would have been different if it had been run by the military rather than by politicians?
Well, the question is, why were we there to begin with? And as you, the more you learn, the more you understand it was a political issue. But our country is based on a civilian as commander-in-chief. And then the expectation that the military leaders would be telling them the truth. Neither of which happened, you know. So that we should never have been there to begin with. This was a civil war that they needed to deal with. You know, I just came back in August of 2019, having gone to Vietnam after 50 years to see, you know, just sort of to try to regroup with an organization called Peace Trees Vietnam. And the efforts to demine the country from all of the arsenal that we had dropped, you know, like 7,000 pounds per person, per Vietnamese, were dropped by the Americans on Middle and South Vietnam. It was, you know, outrageous what we were doing. And yet we believed that, because we'd been told that it was to keep communism away. But this was, this was so bad. And the more I read, the less I want to read, because it just exemplifies what it is, you know, how bad war is. I mean, we have been spending, almost 20 years in the Middle East? And what have we accomplished other than destruction?
Right. I would certainly agree with you on that, too. We were in there in Afghanistan back when the Russians were in there, and they were smart enough, I guess, to leave.
And the same thing happened in Vietnam. The French were there for years, and then we came in the mid-50s, and the Vietnamese call it the American War. because we took over where the French had left off, and we did no better because we didn't belong there.
Yeah, I have a friend. I have a friend who I went to school with who lives in Ho Chi Minh City now. He's been there for 14 years, and that's again what he says. He said he went and had tea in the embassy where, you know, where you saw the helicopters taking people off. And that's one thing the Vietnamese have been very good about is recycling. You know, there's not much in that country that's wasted. And I think that's, you know, something that we can also learn from. What would you say, we've just got a couple minutes here, but anything you'd like to say in closing other than that we should stay out of civil wars?
Well, you know, the military is, I think, a really fine part of institution in the United States. My career in the military was remarkable, and the opportunities that you have, regardless of the bad things that happen with war, it's in terms of essentially being all that you could be. And there was nothing that made me prouder than to wear the uniform of the United States, whether I was here in the country or overseas. So even though we hear bad things, and as you mentioned, run by politicians, that what we do in the name of the United States is also essentially that we have to do the right thing.
Sounds like your dog agrees with you.
Yes, she does.
Yes, that's right. She's marching that line.
Yeah.
Well, you are a colonel, and so I'm sure you outrank that dog for sure. So
he doesn't think so.
Yeah, I'm sure. That's right. Well, thank you very much for spending some time with me and answering some questions. And when we get this, on the air and get it streaming, I will let you know, because you can get it where you are, and a lot of really interesting interviews with lots of people on the ground and every place. So thank you very much, Greta.
Well, thank you.
Okay. You take care and have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
To stream this or any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofashon.org and look under the Shows tab.